So throughout the course of this year, we're trying to figure out how can we possibly arrange our lives around the practices, the habits, the ways of Jesus so that the container of our lives might actually hold on to the goodness and mercy of God that's given to us. We've entitled this Overflow, and month by month, we've been walking through all of the different ancient and yet current practices of the church. And throughout the month of September, we're talking about the disciplines, the habits, the practices of worship and celebration. We talked about the grace and the truth of Jesus that converge in him, that the surest sign of grace is celebration, that the surest sign of truth is worship. Last week, we talked about celebration in particular, and we talked about the joy of the Lord being our strength. And if we could just get a little glimpse, or if we could just tap into a bit of the happiness and the delight of God, how different our lives would be and how our lives become one great celebration as a result. And so this week we're going to focus specifically in worship about worship. And we're going to talk about a story of something that happened to the Apostle Paul and Silas in the book of Acts. The gospel writer Luke wrote a second volume that talks about the early church history. And it says that something happened to them on their way to worship this one particular day. There was a woman who was following them who was in need. Paul heals that woman, and the healing of that woman is something that the people who had kind of, who had manipulated her could no longer make money off of her because of her healing. And so this is what happens, verse 19 of Acts chapter 16. When her owners realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten with rods. After they were severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. When he received these orders, he put them into the inner cell, fastened their feet in the stocks. Now, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly, there was such a violent earthquake that the foundations of the prison were shaken. At once, all the prison doors flew open. Everyone's chains came loose. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. But Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself. We're all here." The jailer called for lights, rushed in, and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. And he brought them out and asked them, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" They replied, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in that house. At the hour of the night, the jailer took them, washed their wounds. Immediately, he and all his household were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had become to believe in God, he and his whole household. When it was daylight, the magistrates sent their officers to the jailer with the order, "Release those men." The jailer told Paul, "The magistrates have ordered that you and Silas be released. Now you can go. Go in peace." But Paul said to the officers, "They beat us publicly without a trial, and even though we're Roman citizens, and threw us into prison, and now do they want to get rid of us quietly? No, let them come themselves and escort us out." The officers reported this to the magistrates, and when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. They came to appease them and escorted them from the prison, requesting them to leave the city. After Paul and Silas came out of the prison, they went to Lydia's house, where they met with the brothers and sisters and encouraged them. And then they left. I want to begin today by asking you to picture in your mind, not going to ask you to share this with somebody near to you. This is just for you and your own imagination alone. What's one of the worst days of your life? It's one of the hardest days you've ever faced. Whatever the hurt or the challenge or the pain, just hold on to that day in your mind for a moment. And I want you to not only think about what happened to you on that day, I want you to also think about this one of your worst days. And think about, what did you do in light of what was happening to you? What was going on? But also, how did you respond? How did you react? What were you doing on this one of your most challenging of days? The reason I have you do this little bit of a thought experiment to begin with is if you were to ask the Apostle Paul what was one of his worst days, the passage that we just read in the Bible has to be one of them. This is what happened to him on his way to church that day. He was seized, he was dragged, he was stripped, he was, as the text says, severely flogged, beaten with rods, he was thrown into prison, he was put into isolation, and he was tortured in the stocks, because the stocks weren't just about keeping you in place, they were also about torturing you at the same time. First of all, how are you feeling about your worst day as compared to Paul's worst day? But what I really want to highlight is not so much what happened to Paul on this his worst day, but what he did in response to it. Because the first thing that Luke tells us in the Bible about what Paul did after all of these things had transpired is this one simple, inspiring verse that about midnight, in the middle of the night, sleep-deprived, beaten, treated unjustly, Paul and Silas are praying and singing hymns to God. Is this what you were doing on your worst day? It is almost impossible for us to fathom that somebody could be going through what Paul went through, and what does it take for someone to have the kind of life and character that could go through these things and become a person of worship in that moment. I mean, we live in such a consumeristic kind of society, in a me-centered society, that this blows our minds. When we think about what does it mean to worship or to go to worship, the greatest single change that's happened in American history in terms of the church has not been a change of belief, but a change of behavior. This is going to put me in the grumpy old man back when I was a kid category, but it's actually true. When I was a kid growing up, you went to church unless you had a fever. If you had a cold, you still went to church. If you had a fever or you were out of town. And other than that, you were in church. That's very different from the mindset today. These are pre-COVID numbers. Barna did some extensive research. The average person, I'm not talking about any old person, a Christian who says they are an active member of a church, the average Christian member attends worship 1.7 times a month. This is down 50% from what it was a generation ago. We just don't go to worship anymore. We don't go to church anymore, not like we used to. And do you know what the number one stated reason by Christians as to why they as Christians don't go to worship as much as they used to is this phrase right here. It doesn't fit my lifestyle anymore. Because what we're talking about is we are now constructing a life and what we want in that life, and then we're seeing if there's any time that's left over, and if there is some excess time, then maybe I'll go to church. But you know, I'm not going to church very much because it just doesn't fit anymore. I've got a lifestyle to keep up. There's an often told story of an elderly woman in the Midwest who is walking in the midst of a snowstorm. The winds are howling, the snow is dumping, and she is walking along the side of the road, and she is walking there when a car pulls up next to her, and he rolls down his window, and he says, "Lady, would you like a ride?" And she hops into the car, and she says, "Thank you." And he says, "Where do you want to go?" And she said, "I'd like to go to the First Presbyterian Church." And he starts driving there, and he says, "What on earth possessed you to go to church on a day like today?" And she said, I didn't decide to go to church when I woke up today. I decided to go to church when I gave my life to Christ 42 years ago. We almost can't even fathom that there was a different way of thinking about this thing called worship and what we do here in the church. And so what I would like to do is, walking carefully through this passage, show you what a difference that worship makes, what worship does, and some of the things that you'll notice in it. The first thing that we notice in this passage that we read today of what worship does is that it gives freedom. This is one of the primary themes of the book of Acts, that the Spirit cannot be contained, that the gospel will always be unleashed. And so Paul and Silas are in jail. They've had one of the worst days of their life. They are singing hymns, praying to God together, and an earthquake happens, and their chains are unleashed. The doors fall open, and they are free. This is the first thing that worship does. It frees us from everything that would try to constrain us. And no, it's not a popular notion, but everyone is serving someone or something. You could be serving power or approval or control or comfort or achievement or even your own desires or your own self. And what you need to know in the midst of all of these things, if you give your life to these things, if you serve, if you worship these things, they will not free you, they will ensnare you. They will enslave you. And that God, revealed in Jesus Christ, is the only one that you can serve that frees you. Here's the irony. We come to church to worship, which means to surrender, to bend a knee to the true King that we just sang about. And in serving him, we are freed. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. And so what happens in worship is simultaneously this declaration of dependence and then independence because we are actually freed in him. You come to worship regularly because if you don't come to worship, you will continue to be ensnared and enslaved by all of these other forces. There's only one who can set you free. The second thing that worship does, according to this passage, is that it heals despair. Did you notice the response of the Roman jailer, who as soon as he thinks that the prisoners have escaped, that he takes out his sword to take his own life? The reason that he does this is that he is personally responsible for them staying in jail, and he will be tortured and killed if they are gone. And I love the moment in the passage, even though Paul and Silas, doors open, chains unleashed, that they're free, they're also free to stay, and that's what they do. And the reason they stay is because of him. And I love the phrase that they tell him, don't harm yourself, we're still here. There's been a lot of guesswork over the decades in the declaration that God is dead. And we just keep worshiping and we say, we're still here. The reason that we are investing millions of dollars in renovating this campus and renewing the promise and refreshing our sanctuary is to be able to tell a sad and despairing world, we're still here. Right here. And worship is what is the antidote to that pain. Worship gives us freedom. Worship then heals despair. Worship awakens need. The jailer's response is to say something that he didn't know. He didn't know he was lost until he was found. Sirs, what must I do to be rescued, to be saved? It awakened, their worship awakened for him a need he didn't know he had. This is what happens for me in worship week in and week out. One of the primary myths of our society is the myth of self-sufficiency, that we're fine on our own, that we don't need anyone or anything, and there's nothing wrong with me. Worship cuts against the grain of all of this kind of prevailing thinking. In other words, what happens in worship is you come to worship And I have the audacity to stand up here as your pastor and say, you know what, you're not all that cracked up that you think you are. You're not as good as you think you are. You need to confess. You got some stuff that you need to deal with. It's called sin. And God is gracious and he will forgive you, but we got to own our own stuff. And you come to worship and we say, hey, you know what? You think you're pretty great. You're not as great as the one who made this universe. And so keep yourself a little bit in perspective. And so we praise. And you come to worship and I tell you, you know what? You're kind of entitled and kind of bratty. And you're kind of absorbed with yourself. And you ought to give thanks. And you ought to be grateful. And you also, you know what? This whole thing is not about you. There is a hurting world out there where there are people who are in need in our community, and we need to be generous and loving and kind, and we need to pray for these people. And week in and week out in worship, I tell you these messages over and over again, and I tell myself these messages. And worship is that weekly calibration that awakens the needs I didn't know that I have. I don't even want to fathom the kind of person that I would be without worship. Think about how much worship shapes the way that we think and the way that we live. And if worship is one of those things that just doesn't fit my lifestyle anymore, imagine how more self-absorbed that we become as a result. It gives freedom, it heals despair, it awakens need, and it unites family. Luke is not even subtle about this. Four verses, four different phrases, he says over and over again, you and your whole household. Over and over again, whole household, entire household, whole household. One of the primary things that Luke is trying to say to us is that the gospel is not just individual to individual, but also family to family. That the primary building block of discipleship is actually the human family. And so they're submerged in the baptism and in the reality of what grace will mean for them, for their family. When Kelly and I were in the process of getting ready to have our first child, Kelly's mother recommended and gave to us a book that was super important for us right at the beginning of the journey. It was called Grace-Based Parenting. And I just want to show you the table of contents here for you to know, because I read this first chapter about how just being well-intentioned as a parent isn't going to get you where you want to go. And that there is this truth that's called grace, and that it creates a secure love and a significant purpose and a strong hope. And that once you can figure out that your primary reason for being a parent is to be the primary delivery system for the grace of God to your family, that it gives you, you and your children, the freedom to be different, the freedom to be vulnerable, the freedom to be candid, and the freedom to even make mistakes. There is a direct correlation between the decline in religious participation and worship in the United States and the decline of the human family. Because what happens in worship is that you and your family get oriented around the rhythm of grace. And by the way, I'm very direct with parents. This is why they don't let me do a whole lot of pastoral care. I'm very direct with parents who come 1.7 times a month. And I just say, if you think that I can disciple your child and shape their Christian character in 1.7 times enough, you are sorely mistaken. That it takes a gospel-based partnership with a commitment. And we will do everything we can to help to train you in grace and your children in grace. But it just cannot be the, hey, what's left over in my life? And oh my gosh, look, I have a fully formed child who is fully into the image of Jesus Christ, who is loving and kind and gracious and is inoculated against all of the hatred and the violence and the nonsense of the world. Look, it just happened automatically. Somebody is catechizing your child. And without effort, it probably isn't the gospel. Worship does all of these things. And this is the point that I almost left out today. It also confronts wrongs. And the reason that I almost left this point out was not just time, but because I'm going to put an image up on the screen that I'm a little nervous to put up on the screen. This is how, if you just, whether you're reading something, listening something, watching something, this is how the messages of the media of the world is categorizing all of America right now, especially in a swing state like Georgia. I have no idea how both sides got my cell phone number, but they both do. Everything tells you it is this versus that. And I am here to declare before you that in the vacuum of the Christian faith, as it's being eroded in our society, what is filling in that vacuum is political idolatry and identity. And if you can't name off the top of your head three things that are severely wrong with whatever political party you affiliate with more, you're kidding yourself as a follower of Jesus Christ. Because the gospel cross-shaped world doesn't fit into the neat categories of those two political parties. And I'm going to tell you how I'm going to vote. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to vote. And I'm going to vote holding my nose. And I'm going to take a shower afterwards. Because as a follower of Jesus, I grieve. I lament where we have come as a country. Annie Lamott says the surest way you know that you have made God into your own image is that he hates all the same people that you do. What Paul does, he's freed. He stays for the jailer to help heal the despair and to make sure that he's okay. And he stays even when the jailer says, hey, the magistrates have met and you guys can go. He's like, oh, no, 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 no. We were unjustly beaten. They can come and escort us themselves. Only the gospel revealed in the habit of worship gives you a place to stand where you don't get sucked into whatever is going on politically and what's in it for me. The gospel says, and week in and week out, we get the courage to be able to speak truth to power. Whether it's about the care of the poor or the care for the gift of life, we as Christians have a critique for what is happening in our world. Told you I should have left that one out. Last one here. Worship offers strength. This is my favorite line in the whole story. After Paul and Silas came out of prison, they went to Lydia's house, where they met with the brothers and sisters and encouraged them. Hold on a second. Wait, what? They met with them and they encouraged them? Beaten within an inch of their life, tortured, thrown into prison, dragging their sorry bodies over to Lydia's house, getting there, falling onto Lydia's purple sofa and saying, let us encourage you a little while. What? Only worship can do that. Because only God can do that. This is a picture of a tragedy that took place in 2023. And this is how Max Lucado describes it. May 1st, 2023, a small aircraft with seven passengers crashed in one of the remote parts of the world, the Amazon rainforest. The Cessna was flying from one small village to a slightly larger one, hundreds of miles south of Bogota, Colombia. Evidently, the single-engine prop failed midair, causing a forced meeting with the dense canopy of trees and the jungle's unforgiving floor. All seven passengers were presumed dead. The odds of survival were minimal, The search area was 100 miles long and 20 miles wide. It took Colombian special forces more than 2 weeks, but they eventually located the crash site. And when they did, they were saddened to find 3 of the 7 passengers had perished upon impact, but surprised to learn that the other 4, all children, all siblings, ranging from ages 13 to 11 months, were nowhere to be found. Not on board, not around the crash site. Colombia stepped up the rescue efforts. The government dispatched 150 soldiers, 40 volunteers, several rescue dogs. Tiny clues of hope were found. A baby bottle here, a small footprint there, used diapers here. The children had been raised near the jungle. The older ones knew which plants and bugs to avoid, and even so, they were just kids. How could they still be alive? Days turned into weeks, desperation grew, rescuers dropped boxes of food, water, even whistles into the jungle, hoping that this would help to sustain the children. But day after day ended in despair, and after more than a month of effort, the search crew began to wonder if the children were purposefully dodging their help. And it turns out that that was the case. More than once, rescuers were within 50 feet of the kids. But the children didn't know if the men had come to hurt or to help. And so they refused the ones who had come to save them. And so Max writes, might that be a parable for our humanity? The overarching message of the Bible is God's relentless pursuit of his family. God began sending message after message, miracle after miracle, mercy after mercy. He used patriarchs and matriarchs and prophets and preachers. He's not beyond using a whale, a donkey, and a burning bush if that's what it takes to get our attention. And the Colombians displayed similar devotion. And they came up with this plan. What could convince these kids to come out of hiding? And so the team got creative. They lowered speakers into the jungle and turned up the volume all the way so that a message could be heard over a mile in every direction. And then, and this is the key detail, they played an invitation recorded by the siblings' beloved grandmother telling them to stay in one place and that this rescue team is here to help. Day 40, all 4 children, emaciated, insect-bitten, weak, and most of all afraid, were found and found alive. Their grandmother's voice called them out of the shadows. They just needed a voice they could trust. And we did as well. So in heaven's finest act of love, God became human. Jesus Christ entered into the jungle of our hurt and our heartache, and he spoke with a voice that we could trust and issued a message that we dare not resist. I've come to take you out of here. You want to know why people don't go to worship right now? Because they're hiding. They're hiding from God. They're hiding from rescuers that they don't trust. Churches all over are like these little speakers in the jungle of our world with the message of salvation. And they can't tell if we're here to help or to hurt. This isn't about fitting a lifestyle. What do I need to do to be saved? And so I will not hedge and I will not back off from the reality of what worship really is, that message of rescue and of grace in the midst of the jungle. And so let us pray. Our loving God and Father, help us now to be that voice that we can trust. On what's got to be some of the hardest and worst days of people's lives, give us the ability to sing and to pray together. Help us to not wake up on a Sunday morning and decide whether to tune in or to go to worship. Help us to give our lives to you, and because of that, we worship. Forgive us for trying to fit you around the life that we want, thinking that the Lord of the universe should accommodate to our rhythms when we need to get in step with the rhythm of grace. Give freedom to the person who feels trapped. Bring hope to the one that's in the midst of despair. Convict the person here who needs to be awakened to their own need. Heal the family that is divided in this room. May your grace pour upon us as we confront the wrongs of this world and offer strength to one another, even in the midst of our wounds. Most of all, God, help us to stop hiding from you, knowing that it is only in Christ alone that our hope, our life, or any of this is found. And how week in and week out we need to sing and to remember of the story of what you've done for us. And that's why we worship.